On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Some of the world's most beautiful and exciting animal species are also its most targeted and endangered, and prosperity is only driving the trend. Centuries ago, to bring a shark's fin to the emperor for soup was an exotic feat of daring and a rare dish. Today, sharks are being fin-scalped by the ocean full for a booming China, where newly rich millions want to eat like emperors. Bear paws sawed off for dinner, tiger bone carved from a vanishing species. You can't build a fence high enough to stop the poachers. Now, Chinese celebrities like basketball star Yao Ming are trying to cut the demand, and intrepid activists are penetrating the trade. Up next on Point, from rhino horn to tortoise shell inside the desperate race with animal trafficking. Joining me today from San Francisco is Peter Knights. He's executive director of Wild Aid. The organization's goal is to decimate the illegal wildlife trade within our lifetimes. Knights has led international campaigns to reduce the bear, gallbladder, and wild bird trade, and has worked undercover investigating the tiger bone, rhino horn, shark fin markets, and more in Asia and Africa. Peter Knights, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Everybody knows about these exotic, or knows something about these, some of these exotic consumption patterns and the trail of destruction that they wreak, but you put a real edge on it and say we're sort of capable of sort of eating and wearing and tacking to the wall the last of some of the planet's most amazing species. Where's the greatest danger and what's driving it?
Well, I think in your introduction you alluded to it. I mean, basically, what's new now, what's different from a few years ago is just the globalization and the sheer amounts of money that is around. And one of the biggest problems is that these are old habits in some cases. They're old activities which went on a small scale historically. And now there are just more people with a lot more money capable of, you know, paying for the last shark to be hunted down, paying for the last tiger to be poached because the money involved is there.
Take us to the killing grounds of just one of the examples that I'm reading about you very deeply engaged with here, and I want to look at some of the undercover work that you've done in the trade. It's amazing, from Africa to Vietnam and China. But you were not so long ago in the Galapagos Islands looking at what's going on there with sharks and sharks' fins. I'm guessing a lot of our listeners don't have a sense of the scale of what's afoot here. Please describe it for us.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, the Galapagos Islands to me, I mean, I've had the privilege of traveling to about 45 countries worldwide, and Galapagos is one of the most amazing and magical places on Earth, and I think everybody has this view of it of being this pristine wilderness from the Discovery Channel and things like that, but the reality is there's 20,000 people living in the Galapagos Islands, and the other reality is that one of the things those people do to make a living in some cases is killing sharks for their fins. And the reason that they do that is it's extremely lucrative. As one of my colleagues said, the only thing they could do to make as much money is be involved in cocaine trafficking. So that's, again, the drive that's pushing this. But they've seized, the authorities there, with sometimes with our assistance, have seized up to 10,000 shark fins in one consignment. And if you think there's four fins on each shark which are used.
That is, the top fin, the two tail fins, or three tail fins, I guess.
It's the lower half of the tail fin, mm-hmm. and then the two fins at the front end. And basically, that's all the animal will be killed for. And in some cases in Galapagos, we've had the situation where endangered Galapagos seals, baby seals are killed as bait. They're used to catch a shark. Then the shark has the four fins removed and the rest of the body is just dumped. So two animals have died for four fairly measly shark fins.
I'm looking at a photograph here from Men's Journal from your work there. It's a magnificent hammerhead. I mean, I wouldn't like to meet it face to face, but it's a magnificent creature and it's headed to the ocean bottom with just its fins sliced off, kind of scalped of the fins. I can imagine people listening and saying, well, you know, it's some islanders in the Galapagos. I mean, okay, there's a lot of sharks in the sea. How serious could this be? How serious is it? What's the volume?
Well, it is global, and it's gone global in the last few years. I mean, it's gone to the most remote parts of the world, places like Palau in Micronesia, where they've had to ban the practice of finning because boats from Hong Kong have come in and started doing this. And, you know, sharks are not like other fish. They reproduce very slowly. They tend to only breed when they reach sort of 10, 15 years of age. And so they're kind of very vulnerable. And for 400 million years, they've been a very successful species. And basically, now we have this new super predator online, human beings, and we are decimating them. Some populations in the Atlantic have gone down by 95% in the last 15 years.
95%?
95%. And it's a combination of industrial fishing techniques, a process called long lining, which, you know, up to 40 miles of line with thousands of hooks catching them, but also that sharks didn't used to be targeted because they're not, their meat is not very valuable in most cases, but the fins are now so valuable. The other thing about them is because they don't have to be frozen, they can be sun-dried. So these fins can be stored in a gunny sack, essentially, with no refrigeration for months on end. So it's very easy for people in very remote areas to take them. And, you know, what we've found is that the industry has just spread globally, that the species that they use have spread. It used to be a few species. There used to be a shark fishery off here, off California here, called the soupfin shark. Now it's everything. It's the smallest little dogfish with tiny little fins, right up to the huge, beautiful whale sharks, the largest fish in the world. And, you know, the market has become so massive. You now have all-you-can-eat shark fin soup for $10 and things like that. So what's happened is that what was a very small-scale, high-level elite habit that went on has now become mass market. And we just did a very detailed survey in China of 24,000 people in 14 cities in China. 35% of them had consumed shark fin soup last year.
Talk to us about that, because I think for some American listeners, that will be an unfamiliar thing. I mean, as you describe it here, I guess it made me think when America's westward boom took off, that was bad news for buffalo.
Absolutely,
as China the same thing, has
Tom.
Boomed here. I mean, these shark's fins in their hundreds of thousands and millions are ending up in soup bowls. What's the tradition there, and what's happened with that tradition, Peter Knights, as China's affluence has soared?
Well, I think, you know, the buffalo analogy is absolutely spot on. I think about that Dances with Wolves movie where they found all the buffalo
the
slaughtered
carcasses,
with the meat gone. It's exactly the same thing with the sharks. With people we've met in Kenya and country in India and places like that that used to rely on shark meat for food source now have that removed, as one man said, because my family's protein is on the bottom of the ocean because they've just taken the fins and dumped the bodies. So what's happened is that this thing, which is seen as a prestigious, high value, almost like, you know, buying a bottle of Bollinger champagne or a Cuban cigar.
Oh, yeah. I used to live in Hong Kong. If you were at a nice wedding, shark's fin soup was on the menu.
Absolutely. And people don't even know where it's coming from. They don't even know, in many cases, it's from sharks, because the Chinese is fish fin soup. Mm-hmm. So, of course, everybody thinks, well, there's plenty of fish around. But, of course, you know, the information needs to get out there. And what we have found quite successfully in Hong Kong, to some degree in Taiwan, Singapore and Thailand, when we've got the information out about what's happening, when we've shown the film of the sharks having their fins hacked off and being thrown overboard, it has affected people. And we've got between 8% and 30% of people in those countries saying they won't eat shark fin soup anymore when they have the information. So a key thing here in a lot of these trades is people really understanding what's going on, where it's coming from, and what's happening. With rhino horn dealers, I had one rhino horn dealer who had never seen a live rhino in his life or a photograph of a live rhino in his life, and yet he'd been dealing in rhino horn for 20 or 30 years.
But here at one time you may have had the emperor or just the high tier of society eating shark's fin soup. Now you've got affluence tied to that appetite and that tradition, driving it in a country of a billion-plus people to a gigantic scale. And it's not just shark. As you say, rhino horn. What else is on the list of targeted extraordinary species there, Peter Knights?
Well, there are three main things. I mean, one is traditional Chinese medicine, which has used things like bear gallbladder, rhino horn, tiger bone, seahorses, and things like that. We're having some progress working with the traditional medicine practitioners. In fact, they're now saying we don't need to use tiger bone. So there is some progress on that. Then there's the exotic food market, which is everything from pangolins, which are small sort of armadillo-like anteaters, to snakes, a massive market in snakes, which in fact the Chinese government has just banned the eating of snakes and pangolins, which is a very progressive step. I mean, a ban in itself is not enough, but it is the first step towards changing attitudes.
So but there not are enough. Some, I mean, it was there with ivory and elephant, and there's been some stabilization there, but elephant's still in trouble too.
Well, the Asian elephant is in trouble, definitely. The African elephant, since the ivory ban, has really stabilized. There was a reduction between in the 1970s and 80s. The African elephant population halved because of the ivory trade, because of ivory poaching, and because of the growing market, particularly there in Hong Kong and Japan, as there was more affluence. And I think there's parallels to that in the shark fin business. But what happened then is when the international ban came in, people in the West generally gave up ivory. They got the message, and African elephant numbers have stabilized around 600,000. There's still some poaching going on, but it's not at the epidemic levels that mean the population is crashing.
And yet some of these populations are getting so small, in tigers down to really small right. numbers. I mean, these gruesome notions of the last of the tigers being killed for some bone-in for tiger penis to make people feel more potent or think they do. Can your efforts like yours at Wild Aid keep up with the scale of economic advancement that's enabling this demand, Peter Knights?
Well, that is the challenge. The challenge is to move conservation attitudes in China at the same pace as the economy is growing. And, you know, if we think about, you mentioned the buffalo scenario, our attitudes to wildlife conservation and to consumption of wildlife have evolved over 200, 250 mm-hmm. years as the Industrial Revolution has evolved mm-hmm. with us. And what's happening in China is that process of Industrial Revolution, of mass wealth, if you like, is taking 10 years. And so our challenge is we have to try and keep up the pace.
Carrie's calling from Amherst, Massachusetts. Hi, Carrie, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. I have to say, first of all, that Mr. Knight, you have a lot of guts to get in there and fight this battle. I almost didn't listen because even thinking about what is going on with animals is so disturbing to me, but I just, my God, I had to. And you already said the main point, which is the information is so crucial, but you're not going to get this information on Fox or any other major network, or PBS for that matter. This is a subject people cannot grapple with, and I don't know how you're going to do it, but it has to be done, and information is key. And I live in a college town, and I think students, college kids, are the ones who are going to take up this battle. And you know, unfortunately, you get marginalized as an animal rights fanatic quack, and that is, you know, and that's all political, and there's an agenda behind that.
You know, Carrie, I don't think there's anything quack around the extremes of danger some of these species are in. We can hear the recognition of that in your voice. Thanks for your call, Peter Knights. Carrie's worried.
Tom, I have to contradict her there, yes, because I actually have done Fox News. Straight up. This is an issue which crosses all political barriers, all national barriers. We work very closely with the Chinese government. They've been very supportive of this campaign. This is not an animal rights issue. This is about the survival of species. And everybody, every country, every culture, every political persuasion can get behind that issue. And that, again, is one of the things that's got to be our strength. This is a unifying issue. It's not a divisive issue. And
unifying, but no less urgent, yeah, because as you yourself
absolutely
point out, I mean, tradition and money mm-hmm. have got an awful lot of momentum. You've been trying to address that with public service announcements mm-hmm. that have even gone into China. You've signed up the basketball star Yao Ming, Ang Lee, mm-hmm. famous director. Mm-hmm. I'd like to listen
Jackie
to
Chan.
Jackie Chan.
Slightly well-known Chinese person.
Yes, for slightly well-known indeed. I'd like to get just a flavor of how you're trying to address this. We've got one of your public service announcements. I think this is Ray Fine. The actor here. Let's listen for a moment and then help us understand how you're pushing this message out. Here's Rafe Fiennes with a Wild Aid announcement.
Remember tigers? When they walked this planet, their grace used to take our breath away. Remember sharks and rhinos and elephants? I remember them all and how we lost them. It was one of the greatest slaughters the world had ever known. A relentless campaign waged against the wild animal kingdom. The motives were economic. Anything that could be sold was taken. We killed for fur and bones and even food. We took them as pets. We made them into medicines. We bought their shells as souvenirs. We used so much of the forest that gave them shelter that in a short time there was nowhere left to hide. We knew it was coming, but as we said goodbye to them, we asked each other, how could this happen? It sounds like fiction, but it will be fact a lot sooner than you think if we don't act now. Never buy products made from wildlife, and help preserve the world's forests by buying fewer products made from wood and paper. Your shopping decisions will make the difference, because when the buying stops, the killing can too.
When the buying stops, the killing can too. It's the motto for the public service announcements of Wild Aid, an organization devoted to stopping animal trafficking, illegal wildlife trade. Peter Knights is its front man, and he's with us this hour. Mackie's calling from Hudson, New Hampshire. Hi, Mackie. What do you hear?
Yes, hi, sir.
What do you know, Mackie?
I told the previous person that I spoke to, I'm from Liberia. That's in West Africa.
Yes.
And I've had the opportunity of eating elephant meat.
Okay.
And my question to the person who was speaking, Mr. Knight.
Yeah, Mr. Knight, Peter Knights.
In some parts of Africa and other places, people depend on these animals for food. So my question is, though I applaud your efforts for trying to save these animals, but it's a beautiful thing to see one alive, but what are you doing to substitute, for food for these people?
Mackie, we've got it. Peter Knights, what do you say?
Well, I think that, you know, it's a very different issue of somebody eating an animal for food than it is to trade it internationally for profit. And I think in many cases, we do have to look at alternatives. Some of the projects we've been involved in have been trying to find alternative employment for people, because ultimately these food sources are going to dry up anyway, you know, because that's the nature of an endangered species. So I think we do have to look as part of the solution is looking for alternatives for local communities, whether it's sustainable farming, whatever it is, that's part of the solution. Part of the solution is law enforcement, and part of the solution is reducing the demand. But I think, you know, that the most of the bushmeat trade in Africa doesn't involve things like elephants and endangered species. By definition, it involves more common species. And as an organization, we're not opposed to that, provided it's sustainable. And you know, that's the reality there.
I have to say, looking down your list, animals here that would be really important to a diet seem the least of this. I mean, shark's fin soup, we've talked about that's considered a delicacy.
I mean, the shark fin itself is nothing.
It has no flavor even until the chef goes to work with the scallions and ginger and all the rest. Right. So, tiger penis, this is clearly nobody's staple. Malayan sun bear and gallbladders from bears. Take us through the list
of things. This is a luxury. These are not staples that people are relying on for a major food source. In fact, in the case of sharks, the fact that they're being taken for their fins is destroying what was a protein source for a lot of different people. So, I think the issue of poverty is a very important one for conservation in general, particularly around protected areas, parks and places like that. You know, we need to try and find people activities other than poaching. But in some cases, they engage in poaching because it's most lucrative.
Give us some of the basics here. For example, tiger. Exactly what we say, tiger bone. Now, who wants to eat tiger bone, and how and why?
Well, tiger bone has been used in traditional Chinese medicine to treat rheumatism and various other things. I mean, the irony of this is somewhat that when they've tested tiger bone products, in inverted commas, most of them haven't contained tiger bone. So it's been largely a placebo effect, even if there was anything there, which there hasn't been anything proven to be. But from a tiger, people will use the genitalia, as you mentioned, for tiger soup. And one of the most pathetic things I've seen is fresh tiger genitalia that have been removed from an animal.
Have you seen those in the market?
Yeah.
Have you seen buyers of that? What's on their mind?
Vietnam.
Doesn't everyone in the world know that tigers are nearly extinct? Or are we wrong to assume that?
Yes, they do. But, traditionally, things that were rare were kind of cool. I mean, we have to, the new sort of mentality, and you see this much more with the younger generation, is that obviously rare animals need to be preserved. The old idea is if it's rare, it's kind of exotic and fantastic. And, I've met people who genuinely said that they wanted a tiger skin to wrap their aging father in because it would give him strength and to fight his illness. And, that was a genuine belief. So we are fighting with that to some degree. But I think the other area is just making it socially unacceptable. If the majority of people, and I'll give you a good example of this, one rhino horn dealer that I was in dialogue with said to me, oh, you environmentalists, my grandson came to me and he watches the Discovery Channel and he said, you're a rhino terminator and you should stop it, grandfather. And I said to him, well, what can I say? That's it's your future, it's his future that you're damaging. I think the older generation can be affected by the younger generation, because ultimately, that generation is going to inherit the world from us.
Long-tailed macaques, the monkeys, macaques, in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
What's the problem?
They were being traded for medical experimentation, and very often now, I mean, it's I think eminently preferable to have captive bred animals that are clear from disease and things like that. But they use very often what they'll do is they'll have a captive breeding in inverted commas facility, and they'll use it as a laundering method to take animals from the wild, because it's obviously much cheaper to pay somebody $5 to trap a monkey from the wild than it is to rear it and feed it.
So it's just a cover, in effect, the so-called right. Captive breeding.
Some captive breeding operations are like that, yes.
What about the bear? I think that you've got bear paw soup. This will be news to people. And the idea that that's still consumed in any volume at all. And bear gallbladders, bear bile. Describe that. I think a lot of people will not be familiar with this trade.
Well, bear soup, I've seen bear paw soup on menus in Seoul, Korea for $1,000 a plate on the menus. And it's supposed to be one of the emperor's dishes and, you know, very, very exotic. The gallbladders are interesting because bear gallbladder does actually contain a compound called UDCA, which has been used in Western medicine. And I think this is the difference between sort of Western and traditional medicine, is that we have found so many different cures and effective compounds in nature. But what we do is we isolate those compounds and then we manufacture them to whatever scale we want to do. You know, that's the problem, is you can't manufacture sharks, unfortunately. But the UDCA has been used to treat liver disorders and even sometimes used to try and metabolize alcohol in some cases.
And so, bear bile, you know, how is that harvested and what for?
Well, I mean, sometimes it's harvested. Harvested, I think, is the wrong word. I think about harvesting corn. I don't think about
forgive me. I'm
massacring
not sure
animals.
Yes,
no, it's used and it's used and it's banded around. And I don't think, you know, it's really it's really the quite one.
I take your point.
But the bile is sometimes taken from. There's been bears poached in North America where just literally the gallbladder is removed. And but in China they also and this I think was done for the right reasons, but I don't think it's had the right effect. They farm bears. They have them in captivity. They stick a tube, and this is something that I filmed in China many years ago, and one of the most, frankly, horrific things that I've seen. A tube is inserted into the side of the animal, a steel tube. Very often it's infected, and then they milk the bile. They literally take the bile from the living bear. The bear's kept in a cage barely longer than the animal, and they'll be like that for 10, 15 years until they pass away. But what the idea behind that was that, you know, by milking these bears, it would replace the demand for the wild bears. Unfortunately, it didn't do that. And what you have is you have a kind of a two-tier, I'm originally an economist, you have like a kind of two-tier market. And on the one hand, you have the wild bear gallbladder, which is thought to be more efficacious because the notion of called jinbu, of sort of inheriting some of the animal and the strength of the animal, is obviously better than a tame animal. And so you end up with the cheap bear bile from the farms, which kind of at a mass market, and then if you really want the good stuff, you still have to go to the wild. So it's a bit like saying, if we make, you know, more low-end Kia automobiles, is it going to reduce the sale of Ferraris? And I would suggest to you, probably not. In fact, probably people, if they have a Kia and then they have enough money, they're going to move on to a Ferrari if they can. So, you know, the notion's being bandied around right now about farming tigers, and I think the danger of this is that you send a very confused message to the public. They can't sometimes distinguish which is legal or illegal. And ultimately, you're not doing anything to dissuade the practice in the long term.
Peter Knights is with us from San Francisco. He's a leader in the global fight to stop the illegal wildlife trade, animal trafficking. Their motto, when the buying stops, the killing can too. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Harold is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Harold. You're on the air.
How are you? Back in the 60s, when I was young, we used to fish in Long Island Sound, and that's when I lived out there. And two things happened that really struck me at the time. We were fishing for, I'm glad he made that proviso about eating is a different thing from just killing and slaughtering animals for no reason. Excuse me. We used to fish for blowfish, which are charming little creatures, really.
The ones that blow up all spiny and prickly and dangerous?
Well, the Asian ones are spiny. The ones here were smooth. And my mother knew how to bone them completely, so they were really good. They used to sell them on the market as chicken of the sea, not the tuna fish. But
what do you think about this killing now, Harold, that Peter Knights is describing?
Let me tell you what I saw. We used to eat the fish, and then we used to bury the rest of the skin and so on underneath rose bushes. So we really did an effective thing. But within, I saw other people in boats. I didn't see them doing this, but I saw other people catching this and then just throwing the dead, let them blow up in the bottom of the boat, and then just throwing them back. Now, in a very short period of time, I don't remember how long, but I'm thinking it was about 3 years, there were just none. They were gone. And I also saw fathers allowing their young children, who didn't know any better, to smash to bits horseshoe crabs, you know, which are prehistoric animals. And I don't know what came of that, but it's...
But it can happen just that fast. Harold, we got it. Peter Knights, what are the species who are really at that kind of point where we may look around in a few minutes and they're gone?
Well, I worked a lot on the wild bird trade for a long time. People bringing wild parrots in for pets and things, and there's a species called the Spix macaw that, very sadly, was never a very plentiful species. Mm-hmm. But the last 20 or so were removed for people's private collections, and 2 or 3 years ago, the last individual in the wild that they'd been tracking died of old age on its own, and so that's gone in the wild. There's still some captive animals, but some of the parrots are up there. The tiger is in a really precarious state. I mean, the figures have been banded round of 5,000 left, but when they go and do some of the detailed surveys in some of these parks, I mean, we were working one park, they said there was 35 tigers. When they did the camera trapping, which is now a much more effective method of counting, they turned out there were two males. And so, wow. I mean, that's a population that's done. So I think, you know, we're constantly getting revised downward estimates of what's left of tigers, and their habitats are isolated. It's not just the trade. But, you know, the trade is certainly there as a threat. So some species of tiger could certainly go within the next 10 or 15 years. You know, some of the rhino species, the Asian rhino species, some of the sharks, we don't really know what's going on with some of the sharks because it's very difficult to count them. But certainly the pressure that's on there. Some of these animals, they get to a certain population level and they just don't effectively reproduce anymore. And I think that's the danger with sharks, is we get to a point where we've certainly seen shark fisheries in many places collapse completely.
Bob's calling from Stamford, Connecticut. Hi, Bob, you're on the air.
You started off the segment talking about three animals in particular that are all eaten in Chinese culture, and I disagree that this issue is unrelated to issues of animal rights. I want to read you one sentence from PETA.org.
PETA,
live animal markets, all kinds of animals, including cats and dogs, are routinely skinned alive and hacked apart piece by piece until they bleed to death. And the problem is not that they don't care that this is cruel to the animals. I read someplace else, I think it was a travel article in the New York Times, that there is an Asian cultural belief that animals are actually more flavorful if they have died in agony. So my point is, when you've got those kinds of cultural attitudes towards animals, trying to stop trade in exotic animals is going to be incredibly more difficult even than it is for issues like whales or fur seals, etc. And because of this, I refuse to do any commerce with China. I won't travel to China. I won't buy Chinese products. I won't support trade agreements with China. I mean, your laws are not going to root out these kinds of cultural attitudes.
Bob, we've got it, and we appreciate your call. Peter Knights, let's talk about China. Let's talk about it for a minute, and we want to do this with full acknowledgement. We know what happened to the buffalo. I mean, there are no clean hands here, but China is the boom country that's coming out of centuries of fairly closed existence and tradition. You've worked hard there. You've got Yao Ming and others. Talk about the whole picture that Bob presents here and how you see it.
Right. Well, I think, you know, there's nowhere in the world, probably ever historically, where not just economy but also culture is changing faster than in China at this point in time. I mean, you know, I've been going to China since 1993, and just, you know, when I first went to Beijing, everybody was riding bicycles. That was it. And now everybody's driving cars. And so everything is changing. Everything about Chinese life is changing. And some of these things will take time, but they're changing very, very rapidly. And I guess our task we've kind of set ourselves is to try and make attitudes to wildlife as one of those things that changes most rapidly. And, you know, there are some encouraging signs in terms of, I've been told, it's kind of ironic, but that these sort of National Geographic Discovery type DVDs are among the most popular pirated CDs, DVDs in China. People, you know, when they get a little bit more money, they then start to look around their environment and say, well, you know, maybe it's just not just about money. So,
but you were telling us just before the
never
break.
Never underplaying the difficulty of this, believe me.
you've done surveys that found that 28% of urban Chinese had eaten wildlife.
Right.
In the last year, Now, we know that's an enormous number. That's a lot of consumption. Mm-hmm. How's your organization trying to address that? Maybe talk to us about Yao Ming in particular. Seven foot, 6 feet tall, Shanghai-born, NBA star, started out with the Shanghai Sharks, of all things. You've had him talking to the Chinese populace about sharks and shark's fin soup. How did you do that? How was it received?
Well, this is here's the irony for you. We actually did something with elephants. We did a fantastic PSA with Yao Ming, Protected an Elephant, which people can see on our website.
Yeah,
and but then he said to us, I would like to do something on shark fin because I feel it's a big problem and I want to do something. So, and Jackie Chan and all these different people have come forward. The younger generation has a very different attitude. The urban population now has a different attitude. And it's changing as we speak. And so that's the challenge, if you like, is to make this stuff so it's no longer clever or prestigious or people think it's good to torture an animal before they eat it. We have to get rid of those beliefs, just as many other beliefs have changed in China in the last 10 or 15 years.
But how's it gone down with the Chinese? When there's Yao Ming, he's a superstar. Everybody in China knows it. When he speaks up against shark's fin soup, is that seen to be bizarre? Does the press carry it? How do you even get it on the air there?
We had 300 news stories from that press conference, which is the most successful press thing I've ever done. And the thing is, people then ask the question, well, why? Why doesn't Yao Ming want to eat shark fin? And that gives us the opportunity to say, well, this is why. And we're actually doing a conference in conjunction with the state, the Fisheries Protection Division of the Chinese government. So people in the government have an awareness about some of these issues. People in the media have an awareness, but we have to then disseminate it out across the country. And that's the task. And one of the ways we're trying to do that is by linking in with the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games, which is the massive event in China, one of the most important historic events. We've managed to recruit a whole series of both Chinese and American Olympic athletes to do these amazing public service announcements, which look like they're something which Nike or Adidas might do, but they're actually public service announcements. Mm. They're being broadcast prime time on China's main TV stations with the backing of the government. So I'm not saying this is easy, but what I am saying is we've got a number of things which are helping us. The government has been very supportive so far, and we really welcome that. You can't do much in China without the support of the government. So, we've got some of the top celebrities, over 80 top celebrities. So we've got a number of things on our side which are just fantastic. We have a media reach of 1 billion people a week with our public service announcements.
Yao Ming says endangered species are our friends. How does that resonate in China? I mean, is that just as obvious there as it is here, or is it obscured by tradition? How do you see it?
Well, I think with the younger generation, the younger educated generation, it resonates extremely well. And I think the blog feedback from this was very good. But I think, some of the older generation, it's all news to them. It's all new. And so it's new information. And I think the challenge really is for us to sort of see out that old generation with old ideas and new money. And to keep the wildlife, while they're around. I think in the future, we've certainly seen this with Taiwan, Singapore, and Hong Kong, and places like that. The younger generation are not so much into this. And the challenge now is a combination of law enforcement, as the guests from Africa said, providing alternatives to local people, and then reducing the demand for a combination of law, and then effectively, getting the message out with the most effective spokespeople we possibly can.
You've gone beyond the public service level here, and even beyond the hunting, into the trade itself. Share some of your experience there with us. Who trades in this? If it's this multi-billion dollar business, how does it work? Where does it work? Is there not government complicity? What's been your experience inside?
In some cases, I mean, one of the things that we used to do, and I don't do it so much more these days, I'm more on the communication end, but basically we go in and try and trace the trade from start to finish. So we go out into the bush to meet the hunters, the trappers, the poachers, try and go out with them, see the mechanisms they used, the way they did it, and then go back to the buyer there, then the middleman, and then see how they shipped it, and then go to the sellers at the other end. And so I've really seen a lot of different aspects of it. And in most cases, it's pretty messy all the way along. In the hunter end of things, they get very, very little out of an animal that might sell for thousands of dollars. They may get a few dollars at that end. And many cases, I've seen them kind of, they know what they're doing is not going to go on for very much longer. They know that
because the animals will be gone, or there's a crackdown.
no, the animals are disappearing. In most cases at that level, there isn't really the crackdown element. You know, I mean, I did something on parrots where they were chopping down the nesting trees, which were scarce nesting trees, to catch the parrots, take the baby parrots out. And they were just saying, well, every year there's less and less. And, you know, so in many cases, they kind of see what's happening. But as I say, they get very, very little out of this. And as I think the former president of Ghana said to me when we were looking at parrot trapping there, he's saying, you know, why are people in Europe and the United States paying my people to degrade themselves by doing this terrible cruelty to animals?
If the demand is so large and so persistent, maybe the only choice is to try and put a fence around these creatures. I mean, you're talking about losing them forever. Can it be done at that level to stop the poaching if the demand is so hard to completely tamp down?
Well, we haven't. My personal opinion, we've spent a lot of our effort putting fences up and trying to do that over the last 30 years, and it hasn't had the effect in many cases, and the demand side has been largely ignored. I mean, we're coming into China now, and it's new information to people in many cases. So I mean, I think we have to work on that demand end. But I think what we saw, for example, with the rhino in 1993, there was a big fuss internationally, and the US even ended up sanctioning Taiwan, for example, on rhino horn trade. And there was a big effort and huge raise of awareness in Taiwan and Hong Kong and Singapore. And basically, the government also there, they tightened up their laws, they made sales illegal and things like that. It was in the newspaper almost every day. And the rhino situation in Africa stabilized. There is still poaching going on, but it was not at the epidemic levels it was. I mean, rhinos at that time had to be 24-hour guard. I mean, some of them had a guard for each rhino, literally, at that level, and they were still being poached. That is somewhat diffused because we managed to put a block on the demand. So I think, and I do draw some analogies here with the drug trafficking. Basically, we can napalm as many coca fields as we want to if people will still pay the high prices for cocaine. Someone will grow it somewhere else. And so if we don't adjust the demand side, I think we are going to lose. And I think one of the biggest hopes of this is that we can, over the next few years, and it really is the next few years, have a massive international global effort on the demand, focusing on places like China, but also here in the United States. You mentioned caviar, you know, Russian caviar. The stocks of beluga and things in Russia are in serious trouble because the mafia's got involved in the business, and it's basically, a lot of it is illegal, and it's from overconsumption. Again, people not knowing. People here go from the United States, they go abroad, they buy ivory and bring it back without knowing that they shouldn't do. They buy turtle shell in particular, which many people don't ever identify as coming from a turtle, coral, all kinds of products. And according to the State Department, the U.S. is the second largest importer of illegal wildlife products.
Let's open our ears to that. You say your dream is to see the illegal wildlife trade go where slavery has gone, to be so unthinkable, so rare. Possible in time?
That's the challenge. We're going to do our best. That's all I can say.
Wow. It's just
we've got some powerful friends, the Yao Ming and Jackie Chan on our side. I think we've got some powerful friends.
It is great to hear, and we hope they do it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Chris is calling from Toronto, Ontario. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? China's a great place to frame my question. I'm a little apprehensive, a little worried about the moral dilemma in, say, picking a cause. I shouldn't say a cause, but, you know, China has environmental degradation and huge human rights abuses and huge animal rights abuses.
So let's eat the tiger. What the heck?
Well, not that. Just I'm a little worried about, say, I put all my energy and focus into animal rights, and it's kids don't have clean water, and the planet begins to roast. Mm-hmm. Like, is there a moral dilemma in choosing, say, one of the three biggies? I know abstractly they're all interconnected, but, you know, you talk about a massive campaign for animal rights. Does that put children's rights sort of on the back burner? That's what I'm worried about. That's the sort of philosophical triage I think people are asked to.
Peter Knights, how do you look at that?
Personally, I mean, I care about all the issues that you mentioned, and I don't. I mean, I'm doing what I believe I can do to help make the world maybe a slightly better place in a tiny, tiny way. When I started getting involved in this, I tried to think. I mean, I was quite disillusioned with the way so much seems to be tied up with political fighting and divisiveness. And, you know, why? You know, one of our slogans is "When we come together, we can do anything." And I think there's very much truth in that. I personally feel that this is one of those issues where you can see achievements in the short term. I mean, we literally did I think, bring the rhino back from the brink in 1993 when people got together behind that one. I think the elephant was the same thing. You can see that when we actually do work together globally, internationally, and we put our politics aside and we have a common interest, we can achieve things. And I think that the illegal wildlife trade is potentially one of those, if you like, a flagship issue that shows, you know what, we can do this. And if we can do this on some of these things which are slightly easier, maybe it'll give us the strength and confidence to come together and do some of the harder things, like, say, global warming, which is obviously threatens a lot of these animals. So I see it somewhat as a flagship issue. I'm not aware of any other issue where they have got, we've got now 80 celebrities, the Bollywood stars, we've got Chinese stars, we've got Hollywood stars coming together, getting free media space to get it out, to get the message out. I think it's a model that can be replicated in some of these other issues. So to me, it's not an either or scenario. It's we need to do all these things. And what I feel we can potentially do with the wildlife is it's a relatively non-political way of bringing people together to try and meet a common goal to make, you know, to preserve our world, to make it a better place. And we need some victories. We need some things we can all get together on to persuade us that we can fight some of these tougher stuff where we have bigger differences.
Let's walk and chew gum and not rhino horn at the same time here. Jan is calling from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Jan, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. And Peter, you're a real hero. You're following your heart. And the kind of awareness that you're bringing is a compassion that doesn't limit itself to animals. It extends itself to animals.
Amen.
So just in response to the last caller, it's not a cognitive process we're talking about. We're talking about the heart. And I'm an old peace pilgrim from the 60s and belonged to one of the first Save the Whale organizations and, in fact, was involved in anti-war, and that was following my heart. I was the girl putting the flower, holding up the flower to the soldiers' rifles.
And what do you see in this fight, Jan?
Well, the comment that I had wanted to make, it was I was reminded of an anecdote with my five-year-old, and she had wanted us to get a big SUV because it was shiny and sexy. And I was explaining to her that, gee, it's a gas guzzler, not good to the environment, and that we'd be really piggy if we had a car like that. And she said, well, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with being piggy? And it dawned on me that as long as you get to be the pig, doesn't seem like there's anything wrong with it. And I think that's what we're talking about, is that people who have, you know, with a lack of balance in their life with money and such, they lose sight of humanity, they lose sight of their place on the earth, and as long as they get to be the pig, hey, you know.
But we are humanity. We're supposed to have more perspective than that. Jan, our time is so short, but thanks for your call. Peter Knights, can that be turned around? You feel it happening. I hear your hope.
You've got to be hopeful. Without hope, you can't achieve anything. If you can't see where you want to end up, you can never get there. But there's obviously huge problems that this planet faces internationally. And very often I think we all feel when our governments aren't necessarily pushing us as fast and as well in the right direction. But I think, there's going to be a tipping point at some point. I think things are slightly changing already. I think I'm sensing some stuff coming out of the corporate world right now where I think whether it's the Warren Buffett donation or whether the stuff that Rupert Murdoch's been up to recently with Bill Clinton, it's like we have to take responsibility for this and we have to start dealing on these things. And even if, we don't all politically agree, let's find our common ground and let's work together.
Peter Knights, you are a hero, and we appreciate your being with us this hour. Executive Director at Wild Aid. Peter, thank you so much, and good luck.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can find out more about Wild Aid and watch their public service announcements at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.